approximately how much was, how much, let's say, a container for liquid would hold, and so on. We have in Yerushalayim today museums that are devoted to the Beis Hamikdash, okay? And they have like replicas of the various garments that were worn by the Kohanim, replicas of the various kalim, whether it was vessels or whether it was the forks that were used and the censers and things like that and so on. They have. So if you ever get a chance to go to Yerushalayim and spend a little time over there, this would be one of the places that I would recommend that you go to visit. So we'll give you some idea. Okay.
No, she can't go to the room because she doesn't. I have a hunch, quite a few of them there.
I have no doubt. I mean, we know that the Vatican contains many things that belong to the Jewish people. Mm-hmm. And of course, they refuse to divulge what they have. They're afraid, obviously, that it would reflect upon their own traditions and their own beliefs, if they would. So therefore, they keep it secret, and only a very few people within the Vatican proper have ever been able to see some of these things. Occasionally, they'll permit a book stolen from Jews, let's say by the Inquisition and so on and so forth, you know, to be photocopied so that a scholar could study it. Yeah, they have. They have loads. Right? The Vatican Library contains a tremendous collection of Hebraica, no question about it. Next, so Nichnas LaHeichal, he came into the basic sanctuary of the Beis HaMikdash, the front of the Yamino. Then he turned to his right, because remember, I pointed out to you the other day, I showed you a diagram of the Beis HaMikdash, and it showed what? You enter through what gate? Through the eastern gate, okay. Okay, so that if you enter through the eastern gate, you're actually facing then the west where the Kodesh Kodoshim is, okay? So you come in, and then which way do you turn? You have to turn to the right. On the limino, okay? And it says, Umokam hoyasham, and there was a place over there, meaning in the floor of the Beis HaMikdash, when you turn to the right, you found a place, which was Amo al Amo, a cubit by a cubit square, right? The tabla shel shayish, and there was a tablet. You notice again, many words. Actually, the word tabla is originally the Latin word tabula, from which we get the word table today.
Tabula.
Yeah. T-A-B-U-L-A. You know, like for example, you know, the Pirkei Avos, we have this question about if a person learns as a child or if a person learns, you know, as an adult, you know, what is he like and so on. Right. So the one interpretation is that, you know, that if you learn as a child, you're learning with a blank
tabula rasa.
Right.
Yeah.
So that's what in Latin they call the tabula rasa.
Right.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. All right. So there was a tablet of the marble, the tabat v'yisokibu, and there was a ring which was fixed into this tablet. Okay. Kishahu magbia. So when he would raise it, then he would take the dust that was underneath it, and then he would put it, where would he put it? He put it into the water, of course, right? So that the dust should appear on the surface of the water, okay? Shenemar, as the Pasuk says, from the dust, which is on the floor of the Mishkan, Yikach HaKohen, the priest shall take Venosan HaMoyim and put it into the water. So we see what was the procedure in the Beis HaMikdash. Okay, Tana, we have the tradition. Filei Shel Cheres Chadosha, Divrei Rabbi Yishmael. Rabbi Yishmael says that the filei, as we said, take it either in the sense of a vial, a container for the liquid, or else take it in the sense of like a flat platter upon which he could hold, you know, the mincha, because that's why I say that it's undecided exactly what they mean at this particular point, okay? But it had to be what? It had to be new. The earthenware had to be new. In other words, it couldn't take something which had already
been used.
Okay? Divrei Rabbi Yishmael. This is Rabbi Yishmael's opinion. My Talmud Rabbi Yishmael, the Gemara wants to know, what reason does Rabbi Yishmael say that must be a brand new one? So the answer is Gomar Kli Mimetzorah. It's because he has what we call a Gezeira Shoba. Whenever you see the word Gomar over here, it means that he learned.
He learned?
He learned. It does not mean he finished over here. It means that he learned.
Yeah,
okay?
Yeah.
And for this, by the way, this is why we call this the Gemara. Okay?
Yeah.
All right? So he learned a Gezeira Shoba by virtue of the fact that the word Kli occurs in two places. It occurs over here in connection with the Sota, and also it occurs in the case of the Metzorah, the person who was suffering from leprosy, and then the day comes when the leper comes to the Beis HaMikdash in order to be reinstated as a member of the community and has to go through a whole series of purification and so on, which extends over several days, incidentally. Okay, it's not just a one-time shot. But it's written over there, that the Kohen shall take water, mayim chayim. This is what the wording says in the connection of the Metzorah, connection with the leper. It says that the priest shall take mayim chayim, literally living water. In other words, this means water which comes from a running stream, right? And put it into bichli cheres, right? And therefore, over there, the assumption is what? That it has to be a brand new one. So if it's brand new over there, then Rabbi Yishmael says, by virtue of the fact that the same word occurs over here, it means that here too it has to be brand new. This is the assumption of Rabbi Yishmael. Okay? All right. I just wanted to add one other thing. In connection with a Gezeira Shoba, which means that you have a similar wording in passage A and a similar wording in passage B. A Gezeira Shoba is valid only under the circumstance that there was already a long established tradition that an eminent scholar had used this for interpretation. You can't come along and make one by yourself. It has to be on the basis of tradition that this is a valid one. So obviously, Rabbi Yishmael, who was one of the great scholars, contemporary of Rabbi Akiva and others and so on, if you remember right. So he had a tradition. Right. So he had this tradition. Okay? So, Ma'alahalon, just as in the case of the Metzorah, it has to be Cheres Chadosha. This is what he says. It has to be a brand new one. So, Afkan Cheres Chadosha. So, likewise, over in the case of Sota, it has to be also brand new. So now the Gemara questions. It says, "V'hotzam and alon." Over there, in other words, in the case of the Metzorah, in the case of the leper, how do we know it has to be brand new? So he says, this, the Pasuk says, "V'shochad es hatzipa v'achaz," that he is to slaughter one of the two birds that form part of the ritual of purification, el kli cheres, right, into a earthenware kli, right, al mayim chayim, upon living water. Okay, so he says, "Ma mayim chayim." What is the meaning of the word mayim chayim? Of course, I translated, water that comes from a running source. So he says, "Well, if it's water that comes from a running source, shalom es esor b'hin melochot, means that it was never used for any other purpose prior to this. Of course, it was brand new, fresh water, right? So ap kli. So likewise, the kli says shalom es esor b'hin melochot, right? So the kli in which the mayim chayim has to be poured also has to be brand new. This is his contention. Okay. So now they ask the following kasha. It says, "Ima lahalam mayim chayim avkan mayim chayim." So they say, "Look, all right. Granted that in the case of the Metzorah, what does it say? It says that he has to use mayim chayim." No, it says over there it has to use mayim chayim, living waters, okay? So Afkan, shall we say that over here, also in the case of the Sota, that the water that he uses also has to be mayim chayim? That's the question, right? So the Gemara says, the Rabbi Yishmael, hachinami, as far as Rabbi Yishmael is concerned, yeah, absolutely. In other words, not only the kli should be new, right? But also it has to be Mayim Chaim. Even the water has to be Mayim Chaim. You can't simply go and take a bucket, he says, and, you know, fill it from, let's say if you have a pail of water, and go take a glass and fill it from a bucket of water. You can't do that.
Standing water, standing
water.
Huh?
Yes, the keel was filled, right.
So that would be
right. Yes, okay, I'll speak about the cure in a moment, okay? All right. So this is what he says, all right? This is his contention. All right. okay. So, yes. So, Rabbi Shmuel said, Ochinami, yes. He says, that's right. I agree. The Omer Rabbi Yochanan, because Rabbi Yochanan said as follows, make your, right, the waters that come out of the basin in the Beis HaMikdash, Rabbi Yishmael says concerning them that may mayon hay, that they are waters of a stream. Okay? But the Chachomim Omrim, but the sages say, Mishor Meimosein, it says that the water in the basin could be not necessarily just from the stream, but it could be also other water maybe that would be added to it from some other source. Okay. So there's a difference of opinion about the water in the Kiyor. However, what Arthur mentioned, I want to tell you what the Mishnah says about the Kiyor. It says, you have it at Gemara and Yuma and so on, in other places, okay. It says over there that there was a very wise person who invented, and the word that they use over there is Muchne, Hayasham. Muchne is like the word machine and so on, like the Greek word machina. In other words, I mean, why do we call it machine? Because it comes from the Greek, okay. So the Hebrew word, which corresponded to the same idea, was the word Muchne. In other words, it was kind of an invention that occurred, and they said that every night when the service was over in the Beis HaMikdash, they had a device in order to lower the Kiyor into a spring of water which existed underneath the temple floor. And there were two reasons for it. First of all, to keep the water fresh, but also we have a law that says that water should not be left uncovered overnight. Why? Because it says that there's a possibility that maybe a snake would come along, deposit poison in it, and you wouldn't be aware of it, and for that particular reason, you would be endangering your life. So that being the case, in the Beis HaMikdash, they weren't taking any chances. They wanted to cover the water for the night to make sure that there would be no possibility, you see, of any animal coming along and depositing anything inside.
Bugs
and so on.
It was matzahs also. The water has to be prepared the night before and is covered up.
Exactly. This is the law for baking matzahs, that it has to be what they call mayim shalodu. Now, what does mayim shalodu mean? It means water which has stayed the night. It has rested the night, but it has to be in covered vessels in order to be used for baking the matzah. Okay? Doesn't mean our water.
No, current law.
Pardon me?
That's not current law.
Yeah. That's still a procedure. Negelwasser is a different story. Negelwasser is, what you do, you take, and why? You want to get rid of not only dirt, but you want to get rid in case there are evil spirits over there, so you get rid of the spirits. Right. But, that's not the same story. I mean, you're not using it either in the Beis HaMikdash, nor are you using it, let's say, for baking butts or anything like that. But that's a general issur that we have, general prohibition upon leaving water uncovered during the night for fear of contamination one way or another.
Or even during the day. It
Pardon
be
me?
Uncovered.
Yeah, of course, no question. I mean, we're more conscious of this today, than we were. But they were already conscious of it in the days of the Talmud. Okay? All right. So, this is Rabbi Ishmael's opinion. Okay. But as we see, the sages said that as far as the water is concerned, it didn't necessarily have to be, that is, the water in the Kiyor did not have to be necessarily water that was Mayim Chaim. Okay? All right. So far, so good. Ikol Mifrach. So the Gemara says, we could question the basis upon which Rabbi Yishmael makes his comment. Why? He says, Ma'alim Mitzorah. In other words, What are we questioning? We're questioning whether can we really make a comparison between the case of the Metzora and say that everything that applies to the Metzora is also automatically going to apply to the case of the Sota, right? So we can question that. Why? Because we say, Ma le Metzora. Look, in the case of the Metzora, it isn't only the water and the klicheres, you know, that we have over there, but we have other elements over there that are not mentioned in connection with the Sota. What are some of the other elements? Okay, in the case of the Metzora, we find Ta'un Eitz Erez, right? You have to have like a branch of cedar, right? Be Ezo and Moss, right? Ushni Hyssop, right? Whatever you want to call it, right? Ushni Salas, and also scarlet that they have to bring, okay? The Torah says that this is what, you know, this is all part of the ritual of cleansing the Metzora from his tzaraas, or from his leprosy, okay? So that's mentioned over there. But where do we find, you know, that in the case of the Sota, that it has to be a new vessel? Where does it say that? Doesn't say that. So Amar Rabba, so Rabba says, I can prove to you. He says, what? Omar Kro, he says, the Torah says, Bichli Cheres, right? It says that in the case of the Sota, what does she have to do? She has to bring, all right, or the Kohen brings the right water, Bichli Cheres, right? Or, all right, the Kohen has to bring the Bichli Cheres. So, Kli Cheres, he says, Kli Shamati L'chol Kibor. That means a Kli that we're already familiar with from a previous passage in the Torah. Now, naturally in the Torah, which comes first? Is the Metzora or is it Sota? The answer is Metzora comes, because Metzora is found in Vayikra.
Right.
And this is already in Bamidbar. All right. That's already a different problem as to whether we go by the rule of Ein Muktam and Rucha B'Torah, which means that you don't go necessarily by chronological order in the Torah, because there are passages that are not in chronological order. Right. So there's all the discussion in Gemara as to whether it applies or it doesn't apply, and one opinion is that it would apply if you have one parsha right next to another, but it wouldn't apply if it's scattered all over. That then there isn't necessarily a connection between them or the other. But anyway, this is Rabba's point. According to Rabba, you know, look, everybody's entitled to a point of view. These are great scholars. They studied the Torah better than we have studied it, right? They studied every single passage, every single point of it, and they had traditions. So his tradition was that the Kli that is referred to in the case of the Sota has to be the same type of a Kli as mentioned in the case of the Metzora. And with the Metzora, we already proved from the fact that it says, Mayim Mechayim, that, you know, it has to be running water, never used before, and so on and so forth. So therefore, the Kli too has to be a brand new one. So that's the kind of a Kli, says Rabba.
I think so.
Yeah.
We wouldn't really be concerned about the chronological order anyway. When you're talking about a term that is
right.
The first time you encounter it in the book,
right.
Then you'll define it.
Right.
The next time you encounter it, you assume that it's already understood.
Okay, very good. Except that sometimes it works backwards.
It has to do with the, you know, with the order that you encounter.
Yeah, I understand. But it isn't necessarily so. I have to tell you, sometimes, in other words, let's say, very good, you have A and you have B, right? So, it may be as what you said, that if you find it in A, then in B it means the same thing. But sometimes we don't know exactly what is the meaning of A until we come across it in B. And then we work backwards, you see. So it isn't necessarily in the order in which we find it. That's why, I mean, you could have questioned Robert too over here, you see.
Right. The problem that he's using is based upon, you know, since it was first defined as this.
Right. I mean, this is what he's saying here. This is his point of view, okay? All right. As you can see, that this doesn't go, it isn't just, this is it, bing, 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 and nothing else. They have different points of view, they question us, well, doesn't mean this, doesn't mean that, and so on and so forth.
The is different philosophical outlook on life,
right.
Many, many cases.
Yes, this is true too, right? No question about it.
They're receiving a tradition they received from their parents and grandparents back to Mount Sinai, therefore
the tradition, there is only one really oral Torah given in Mount Sinai. Therefore,
right.
it must have diverged. There must have been mistakes
yeah.
made in the handling.
No. Well, I wouldn't say that's a mistake, but there are different ideas, different traditions concerning what precisely is the meaning of this or that or the other thing. This is the thing.
And
right.
sometimes
yeah.
it's forgotten. And it
right.
up again 3 generations later.
Yeah.
Well, that's what could account for differences.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Right. All right. So, along comes another scholar. This is Rava. Okay? You notice that Rava, we say, is with a A, and Rava is with an olive. Of course, if you look at an English translation, how do they distinguish it? So they spell Rava R-A-B-B-A-H. And Rava, they spell R-A-B-A, in order that you'll tell the difference between them. But, you know, it's a lot easier to do it in Ashkenazi the way we do it. So we say, Rava and Rava.
They come with mistakes.
Right.
I thought they were the same. I'm glad you...
No, they're two different scholars.
One is with a
hey,
one with an
I just noticed
it. Hey, one with an I, one with a Y.
Right. So, Rav, Omar Rava, Rava said his father, says, Lei shonu... He says that the kli that we're talking about has to be a kli where it has not become darkened through smoke or something like that. I mean, after all, if they were bringing things to the Beis HaMikdash, you know, to the altar or something like that, obviously there was fire over there and smoke, right? So it has to be a kli which has not become darkened with smoke, as I said. Okay? It has to be a nice shiny face to it. Okay? Yeah. Avol nesak mupanov. What would happen if the kli did become dark, did become black? So in that case, psulin. Then it becomes invalid. You can't use it. My Tama, for what reason is this so? So it says, Dumya the Mayim. Look, we're using the Kli, and what are we using it for? We're using it for Mayim, right? Water. So, Ma Mayim, just as in the case of water, Shelo Nishtanu, water doesn't change its appearance. Even if you add more water to it, is it going to look any different? Not going to look any different. So that even if you accept the point of view that the water in the Kiyor, let's say, could come from any source, whatever, not necessarily, you know, from a mayon, right? As Rabbi Yishmael maintained. But nevertheless, does it look any different? No. It has to look nice and clear. So likewise, in that case, ap kli, so the kli itself too, shelo nishtana. It did not change in appearance. Boy, Robin. So Robin asked the following question now. Says Nisakbu Kivshon Hoesh Nislabdu Mahu. What would happen? Let's say that the kli did become blackened. Okay. It happened. So then what did they do? They took it and they put it back into a furnace or a kiln, whatever you want to call it, right? And in the process of burning it out in the fire, what happened? It became became white again. This lavda from the word lavan, right? So, what's the din? He says, "Mi amrinon." Do we say kevon the itchu? Inasmuch as it already has been literally pushed aside. In other words, we already declared it invalidated. So, even if we now change it back to the original appearance. But once invalidated, it stays invalidated, right? Oh, Dilma, or maybe he says, Kevon the Hodur Hodur, inasmuch as it has returned, Hodur over here means return, okay? Inasmuch as it has returned to its original appearance, then we say it has returned, therefore, to the state of being able to be used, okay? Again. So, Toshba. Come and listen. We have another teaching. Rabbi Eliezer or Maria Elozer, Oymer, he says, Eitz Erez v'Eizo v'Shni Solas Shehiv Shubahem Kupose Liachirov Isulin. Let's take the case of an Etzora, right? He comes to the Beis HaMikdash because he wants to be cleansed of his leprosy. Okay? And what did we say he has to bring with him? He has to bring with him eight eras, right? Branch of cedar and hyssop and the shani, you know, the scarlet, the crimson. So, let's see. He brings him, of course, let's say, in a basket, okay? Bringing him. But he discovers that it's too heavy a burden for him to do it. So what does he do? So he gets a great idea. He takes them, he ties them together, makes like a rope out of them, and then he lets it hang from behind him, okay? He slings it behind him, all right? Then he comes to the Beis HaMikdash, and naturally what's going to happen over there? Once he gets there, he untangles everything and smooths them out, okay? So the question is, in this case, shall we say that it still is valid for making the Metzorah cleanse, you know, from his leprosy, or would we say that it now has become invalid by virtue of the fact that it was used for a different purpose to begin with, okay? This is what the question is that he's raising, okay? Mm-hmm. So, he says, if this is what happened, then he says, you know what? Pesulin. They become invalid. Right. Why do they become invalid?
Didn't have the basket, right?
Well, no, it's not necessarily a basket. He made a rope, let's say, out of them. Okay,
and
dragged it. Yeah, but that's not the reason. He says, well, indirectly, you're right. Look, over there, in the case of the man who did this, right? So, Hadre Umifshate, right? What happened? He again straightened it all out, and therefore we should say that if it returns, Hadr, right? So it should be valid, right? So why do we say that it's not valid in the case of the Metzorah? So the answer is, Hasim, in that particular case where he made it into a rope and slung it behind him, he says, the Ikluf, Iklufi. The reason being that if he's schlepping along, some of it undoubtedly will be peeled off. And if it's peeled off, then it's not the original, and so you cannot say that it's not a hole anymore. So you cannot use it. But of course, the question is, but what about where we said just a few moments ago that let's say he put it into the furnace? No. Let's say that in the case of the Sota, that the Kli Cheres that he had, he put it into a furnace and it became white again. Can we say that, it's okay? We said, Kevin, you know, this is the question. Do we say that it is once rejected, it remains rejected? Or do we say that inasmuch it has now returned to its original, it is okay to use? You understand? Mm-hmm. In other words, can you say that the analogy there, in other words, have we done anything to this to diminish it in any way? As in the case of the other one where something got peeled off.
Yeah. I don't understand the whole concept.
Yeah.
In the Beis HaMikdash, the connection with the Kavanos.
Right.
You have all kinds of little things, tongs and spoons. And
right,
things.
Right.
They automatically get slightly dirty and used, they're going to be cleaned again.
Right.
Most likely.
Yes.
So, how he ate this and he ate this, I don't understand.
Well, isn't there
but
a difference?
As you can see, I mean, there is, this idea is that inasmuch it's no longer is exactly the same quantity that he started out with, therefore it becomes invalid.
I'm talking about the Kli Cheres.
Right. Now, as far as the Kli Cheres is concerned,
because he's starting out with it.
It's theoretical. Okay, it's theoretical. But let us say then that it had become blackened, and he puts it in. So can we say that having been rejected, it should remain rejected? Or can we say that once it has been restored to its original state as a result of being put into the furnace, it is now permissible to use it again? Okay, this is the question.
That depends on the chemical reaction involved. Obviously,
right.
He must have lost some matter in the process.
It's quite possible,
yeah.
Right. So
it
all depends.
We're talking about burning it off.
Yeah.
We're talking about an oven. So burning it off, you might lose a piece of the surface.
Possibly.
Which it adhered.
Right. Okay.
You put a little more of it and bake it in again.
Yes.
No,
okay.
Be
all right.
Original.
Anyway, question is, again, from the point of view of halacha, does the Sota require a new vessel? This is the question.
Would it appear to me the other way around? Logically.
We find every reason to fill it. this case, the ruling of Rabbi Yishmael that has to be brand new is the accepted reason. The Rambam says so, and of course the Rambam is the one who made most of the decisions concerning what is valid or not in the Beis HaMikdash.
And okay. It does have to be brand new, so this goes against the idea of the logic of less than perfect with all the things that
correct,
are going on.
Correct, correct. But nevertheless, the point is, again, we are learning. All right, this is not for the moment something which is practical halacha. Okay? May it be God's will that the Beis HaMikdash will be rebuilt, and we will again have to struggle with all these things that we're learning over here, okay? But, nevertheless, what we see over here is, how do they rule? How do they dispute? What basis are they using? And so on. So that the more that we study this, the more we can begin to try to enter into the mind of our sages and see how they viewed scripture and how they viewed oral tradition and what they were able to do with it. Yeah. So we have a principle in the Gemara of Drosh V'Kabbal Schar, which means study, interpret, and receive reward for it. In other words, it's important for us to study even those areas which are not applicable to our life today, because from them too we receive a reward for learning what it's all about, and we can use it of course and apply it to other situations as well. Okay, with this we shall stop tonight and continue next week. We are now on Tezvov Omid Beis, roughly about 2/3 of the way down. Okay, we're on Tesbov, Ahmed Bey's 10.5 lines from the bottom. Okay. All right. We were discussing the procedure that takes place when the Kohen brings the woman, if you remember, and, you know, now they are ready to enter. Remember, first he received the mincha, you know, consisted of the Bali meal offering and so on. And then what is the next step? So the Mishnah says the next thing that he does is that he goes into the temple proper, and then it says Afono Liyamino, and he turns to his right. So the Gemara wants to know, my Talmud, what is the reason that he turns to the right? Why could he turn to the left? Something like that, you understand? Again, picture. The entrance is from the east, right? This is the Holy of Holies, okay? So, if he's turning to the west, that is, I mean, excuse me, he's turning to the right, he's really turning towards the north. And then he makes his way around and so on and so forth, okay? So, the question is, why? So, the answer the Gemara gives is very simple. It says, the Omar Mar, as you know, one of the sages said, says, Kol pinos shato pone layuhu eladerach yamin. Now, in modern Hebrew, the word pino always refers to a corner. Okay, but here it means really turnings, all turnings that you turn, in other words, wherever you come in the Beis HaMikdash and you start in to make the rounds, you have to go lo yehu elo derech yamin, only to the right. I would say that incidentally this is probably the reason why technically when we take out the Torah from here, how should we go?
Yeah,
we could turn to the right and then come around this way, and so, because this is the right way based upon.
To the left, you face the Orient College.
You're facing
to the left.
All right, but you're facing the congregation.
The Ark is in the east, right?
Yeah, okay, fine.
The Holy will be in the east, and it turned to the right, he went to the right.
All right. Whichever way, if you're going to carry the Torah around to the congregation, you're bound at one point or another to be. No, not exactly facing the ark, okay. As far as I'm concerned, you can also have kindness to the rabbi if he puts the podium right in the middle of it there, too.
Right.
Okay. So that's why some people will, you know, they have the podium off to a side rather than. Right, yeah.
Is there a particular, now when the cantor is facing the congregation, he says the Shema.
Yeah.
Now he turns.
Right.
Where should he turn? Again?
He should really turn first of all
right.
To the right.
Right.
He should turn to the right.
Of
course, what I see, you know, the people lined up over there, you know, right in front of the ark.
Right.
That's right.
But the correct way is that they all went to the right.
Right.
Correct?
Yeah. Technically, they should turn to the right. There's no question.
It's like
the right
holding
way.
The Torah on the right shoulder.
Correct. Yeah. Author.
Author and author.
Anyone else? Yeah. All right. No.
Maybe he went to get his book. Then.
Maybe. I don't know if he's joining us or he's going to the bond meeting. I have no idea.
Oh, is it a bond meeting?
I think there's some kind of a planning meeting.
There is a bond meeting.
Yeah. Okay. Now, the Mishnah then continued to say that there was a certain spot, if you remember, the Mishnah says, Bokam Hoyashom Amma al Amma, right, which was one Amma, in other words, an Amma square, right? And it said also that it had a tavla, in other words, like a tablet, a slab, right, covering that area, with a ring attached to it, so that what they could, what could they do? They could lift up the ring, and that would expose the soil underneath it. And from this, this is where they would get the dust that they needed in order to mix with the water to create the Mayim HaMorer. Okay? That's what the Mishnah says. So, Tanu Rabbanan, sages have taught us, Umin Ha'afor Asher Yeh, the Pasuk says, and from the dust which will be, where, of course, the Karka Mishkan, it says, in other words, on the flooring or the soil, you know, of the tabernacle, right? So then, you know, the Yikacha coin, and the coin has to take afar, right, and put it, and mix it with the Mayim Chaim, right, with the living waters. Well, the Mayim Kedosh. The term that was used, actually, in Sota, is Mayim Kedosh, holy water. So, the Gemara wants to know as follows. Okay. It says, from the dust, Ashayiyah. Now, when you say the word Yochol, in the language of the Gemara, Yochol always asks the question, wants to know, maybe, is it possible that maybe we can interpret it a little differently? Mm-hmm. And then, once we've raised the question, then of course, then we have to look for an answer. That's how you get this, you know. You ask a question, you have to look for an answer, okay? Give you a simple example. This is from the Pesach Seder, okay? Does anybody remember the word Yochol over there? That's right, it says Yochol Mevesh Chodesh, right? Talmud Leimar Bayom Ahu. The question there is, maybe we should begin reciting the Haggadah and celebrating Pesach with Rosh Chodesh Nisan, right? So, for Talmud Leimar, this is why the Torah text says Bayom Ahu, which means on that day, meaning which day? This is the day upon which we were commanded to remember the Exodus, you know, from Egypt, right? Right. So that's the day, okay. And that may say, Yochol Nibo'ed Yom, maybe we could begin saying it already while it's still daylight out. So Talmud Lomar, Bo'erev, has to be in the evening, and so on and so forth. Okay, so you see, this is how the terminology runs. Yeah. We have to get used to the terminology of the Talmud. It's not easy, believe me. It takes a little experience to begin to get the feel of it. Because don't forget, again, we don't have question marks, we don't have commas, we don't have periods. It's very rare to find a period in the text of the Talmud. So you have to sort of be able to figure out, you know, from the ribbon or from the, naturally, from the situation, the context, and, you know, exactly how to phrase it. There are modern editions, like, for example, the Steinsaltz edition. Yeah. There he put in vowels and punctuation to make it easy, you know.
I was reading it today, trying to help me.
Yes?
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Okay. Okay. Well, I'm glad to know that you were doing your homework. All right. So, Yochol, the question is, Yisakin mibachutz biyachnis, maybe he should prepare dust, right, while he's still outside the temple precincts, and then bring it in together with him, right? Mm-hmm. So Talmud Lomar, what does the Torah say? Talmud says, Bekarka HaMishkan, right? It says, on the floor, or the ground, actually, of the Mishkan, right? So then the Gemara asks the following questions. E Bekarka HaMishkan, okay, granted it says Bekarka HaMishkan, right? Flooring of the tabernacle. So Yochol doesn't mean Yachpor Bekardumos, that what he has to do is to take some axes, Kardum is an axe, and chop up the soil so he can scoop up something. Talmud Leimar, so Torah says, no, it doesn't have to go to all that. It simply says, Asha Iye. In other words, soil that's already available. Okay, so how can you reconcile this business? So the answer is, Yesh Shom Hove. If there is soil over there, then bring it, take it. In other words, right? Ein Shom. If there isn't any, Tein Shom. So you know what you should do? Put some soil over there.
Practical.
Right. So then all he has to do is put it, get it ready, and then you have soil to take, to pick up. Tanya Ida. Now, there's another literally teaching, you know, which means that there's another statement that we find, which is not exactly in agreement with this one. What does it say? It says, Umin ha'ofor asher yiyeh. Right, what does it mean? And from the dust which is there in existence, melami. This teaches us shehoya mesakein nibachutz machnis bekarka mishkan. This teaches us that he would take prepare soil, dust outside the temple before he came in, right, and then he would bring it in, and what would he do? He would put it in the karka mishkan. So, in other words, there's obviously a slight contradiction over there between them, because one presupposes that the Karka Mishkan is already there, but you don't have to go to the lengths of, you know, using axes in order to chop it up so you can get some soil, but you can bring, let's say, from someplace. But this implies that this would be the general procedure to do what? To bring in soil from the outside so that the Kohen doesn't have to it doesn't have to chop it and so on. So there's a slight contradiction, as you can see, between one and the other. Pardon me?
They have bare floors in the Mishkan?
Okay, yeah, that's a very good question. Obviously, they had flooring.
They had flooring over there.
If anything, they put in marble on the floor and everything else. Okay. Yeah. This is why we learn that they had a, you know, this tablet, which had a ring in it so that they could pull it up.
Yeah.
Okay. But obviously, what was underneath the marble? It was dirt over there. So that this is the reason why they could do something.
So they
like
dug
that
in under the...
Right.
Under
yeah.
The,
yeah.
So they didn't have a foundation, so to speak.
Well, it's right on top of the mountain, you know. That's the Harabayas, so that...
If they had to do it frequently, they would wind up with a hole under there. So it would occur to me that they would have to keep putting dirt in there.
Nope, they have. They're okay.
I mean,
I don't think that,
that
they did, that they had a garage sale.
Yeah, and I don't think that this happened that frequently.
No, it didn't happen that frequently,
right.
I assure you.
Or if it happened at all.
Yeah.
Well, I wouldn't say that it never happened, because there must have been a possibility in the case like this.
No recollection in the Talmud.
As a general rule, the answer is no. But, as we see, you know, first of all, not only is the whole ritual prescribed over here, but the Torah says, so, you know, but they want to try to be prepared for any eventuality that might occur, okay? But, secondly, we'll be learning a little bit later on that a queen by the name of Helena Malka, okay? She was a queen of a country that had converted to Yiddishkeit. Okay? And one of the gifts that she gave to the Beis HaMikdash is a golden tablet upon which these words for the Sota were inscribed, so that the Kohen would have the text in front of him, you know, at the time when would perform it. So, there may have been. I mean, we don't know. There's no statistics as to how many times, you know, a woman was tested to find out whether she's something.
How come they didn't have better water for a man?
Well,
he can be
I could make a joke and say that she embittered his life.
She what?
She embittered his life.
When he suspected that she was fooling around with somebody else, it was, you know, it wasn't so pleasant. It was a bit of bitter, okay.
But there is a rationale.
But that's only a joke.
Because since Judaism depends upon the mother, you know, so that the birth, any birth, has to be a protected birth, because that's how they carried on the generations, through the mother. And I think that may account for why there were more restrictions and these frightful consequences if they did something that was wrong.
Well, yeah, as I said, I mean, I don't know that anybody ever took statistics on how many cases of sotas were actually brought to the Beis HaMikdash. We do know that, I mean, we learned already before that when times came that they felt that the men themselves were fooling around too much, then they stopped the whole practice. Mm-hmm. They simply abolished it, so to speak.
Did they really?
Because they, yeah, yeah.
During the time of the temple?
Yeah, during the time of the temple. In the latter days of the Beis HaMikdash, they said that it lost its validity because the men themselves were not living a pure life. You know, if the men were so holy and so, you know, that, you know. But when they started to fool around, and that was it. That was the end of the
ordeal of the
soda. Sure, they were
fooling around before the women.
Right.
So why did they start it?
Right.
How can they fool around without the women?
Okay. All right. So, first of all, then, we see that there is a difference of opinion as to whether, if it's there, obviously, this is where you have to take it from, right?
Mm-hmm.
If not, then bring and take. And the other one says simply that they brought in from the outside, and then they put it on the, you know, obviously they put it over there, and then the Karka Mishkan is supposed to be ready. All right, so it's not resolved, of course, needless to say. Okay, not resolved. But again, you know, they ask now the following question. There's a scholar by the name of
right.
That's
the idea.
That's a wrong thing, yeah.
Okay. What did Issi ben Yehuda say? He said, Lohovi karka shilo, no vegibon uvei selomim. In other words, it says over there, minhua four, right, from the dust of Sheyeba karka hamishkon. So it says, if it says karka hamishkon, this means to include not only the tabernacle, in other words, he takes it literally in the sense of the tabernacle, the one that existed in the wilderness, right? But also to include those places in Eretz Israel that were where we find the sanctuary established once the people of Israel came into the land of Israel. One of them was Shiloh, mm-hmm. Okay?
No, Gibeon.
Another one was No. The third one was Gibeon, and then finally the Beis Elohim, in other words, the temple in Yerushalayim, the one that became literally the house for eternity, okay, in Yerushalayim. Okay, so in other words, according to him, then this law of the Sota would apply to all of these various places. Obviously, there is a difference of opinion as to whether any of the other preceding sanctuaries really qualified or not. Okay? Mm-hmm. Issi ben Menachem, he's another Issi, not the same Issi, different Issi. Omer, he says, Eino Tzorich, he says, I don't need a pasuk for that to teach me that. Why not? He says, Ma bitumo kalo lechola kakotu. If it was a matter, for example, of, let's say, a light
indiscretion,
it's not really indiscretion. Tumor, of course, means that you're in a state of impurity,
right.
Okay? Mm-hmm. And there, the Torah did not make a distinction between what? Between the Beis HaMikdash and between all the other sanctuaries that existed prior to the Beis HaMikdash.
Yeah.
So, inasmuch as in Tumah Kala, we'll read the Rashi at the moment. So the Tumah Seishas Ish, when it comes to the impurity involved where a woman is unfaithful to her husband, right? Then in that case, Tamura, and this is already, you know, a severe type of impurity, low culture came. all the more reason that there should not be any distinction. So in other words, he doesn't need a pasuk to say that. Okay? All right. So, what is the two more column? So, Rashi on the top line over there, my text is a little blurred. I hope you have a clearer version of it over there. But it says, Likoneis betumas haguf lemikdash. All right. If a person enters the... On the top, yeah, the right.
The right top.
Right.
Right, correct.
What's English?
Yeah.
Okay.
Oh, I see it. Take a look also at Tosfos for a couple of domes too when we get this. Because Tosfos has a different outlook. Okay. So it says, Ma Tumakala, says, Nikones betumas haguf lamikdash. In other words, if you enter the Beis HaMikdash with an impure body, in other words, you know, you have come in contact with some source of impurity, whatever it may have been, and then you come into the Beis HaMikdash, which of course you're not allowed to do, because to come into the Beis HaMikdash you're supposed to come in already cleansed from impurity, okay? So nevertheless, what are we saying? So we say that the penalty for that is She'eino b'misas bezdin Elo Kores. This, of course, we learned from the Gemara when we had a Makos, okay? It says that for this, there is not a penalty that the person has to be condemned to death by a human court, but rather the punishment is Kores, which means that he decides for it that you should be punished, okay? Nevertheless, the Cholak HaKosev, right? The Torah text never made a distinction between mikdash and mishkan, between the word mikdash and between the word mishkan. Mikdash, of course, being sanctuary, and mishkan being
tabernacle.
Tabernacle. Okay? And yet, I mean, the word tabernacle, I mean, doesn't do justice to the word mishkan. Because what is a tabernacle? Tabernacle in Latin, which happens to be a, okay, means really like a tent.
Yeah.
This is what it means. Okay? So when we call it a tabernacle, it's because the goyim in the translation, they translated, you know, of course, I mean, the Hebrew says Ohel Moed, right? Which means literally the tent of meeting. Because part of it, you know, if you remember, part of the Mishkan was a tent made with all kinds of skins and coverings, right, and so on and so forth. Okay.
But it had sides. It had regular,
yes,
it had regular
sides. Also, you know, you had to put up a courtyard all around,
yeah,
with boards all around and so on, okay? So
temporary. It was temporary.
Yeah, it was temporary.
Yeah,
because
but they had all pieces.
Right, you set it up,
the pieces,
and then you,
yeah,
could take it apart and move on to the next place. Okay. But the word Mishkan in Hebrew means, you know, really more. After all, when we think of the word Mishkan, what is it related to? Right, exactly. It's related
Mishkan
to the idea of Shekhinah, the divine presence. This is the place where the Rabbeinu Shalom said, "Mishochanti b'sof b'nei Yisrael," right? And I will dwell in the midst of the children of Israel. So that this is the place. So whether we call it a Mishkan or whether we call it a Mikdash, in any place, it's a very holy place. There's no question about it. One stresses the root of holiness, and the other one is that God's presence is there. Okay? But from a technical point of view, of course, the Mishkan was what existed prior
to
the building of the Beis HaMikdash. Okay? That's from a technical point of view. So, the Torah never really made a distinction between Mishkan and Mikdash, says Rashi. Right? How do we know? Shenemru b'parsha Torah, Torah Duma. All right, remember in the Torah at the beginning of Parsha Chukas, the first chapter over there deals with what? With what they call the rules concerning the Pora Aduma, the red heifer, which, if you remember, you know, they had to slaughter, and then after that they would burn it, and then after they burnt it, you know, so then they mixed the ashes, you know, with the Mayim Chaim, and this they use as a water of purification from Tum. Okay? All right. So there, what do we find? We find Shnei Psukim, we find Tum Psukim, right? It's written over there, Ki es mikdash ad Hashem timei, right? And then we find another passage which says, as Mishkan HaRashem Timei. So what do we see? We see that over there, what are they doing? They're really equating the word Mikdash and Mishkan to say that it refers to the same thing. So lo kol shekein, all the more reason then that the Torah made no distinction, then obviously it means then that that in all of these places it is possible to carry on, says Rashi, the levodka, the diko, right, uvara, okay. And in other words, one of the things that you can do is to carry on the business of examining her to find out, you know, whether she had committed adultery or not. Okay. So this is Rashi. Facing Rashi, we have Tosfos. Okay.
Yep.
Tosfos speaks about the rabbos dova givon, right? Shiloh veselo, right? Okay. Rashi gores, in other words, they say Rashi reads as follows, that lohovi karka beiselon, right, to bring dust of the Beis HaMikdash. All right, the shibesh hagirsa, and then we find, however, that the version is not quite correct in its reading. It says shilo no v'gimo, right? Why? So says Tosfos, mishum de no v'givon ein mashkin bahen sotos. In neither Nov or Givon was it permitted to even give, you know, this water, the Mayim Hamorim, to the sotos. In other words, it was not carried on over there at all. So of course the question is, why is it included? So the answer is, according to Tosfos, because they simply, you know, the text just ran, you know, and somebody put it in the text over there, okay? We have what we call Shigras Haloshim, which means literally that the tongue runs on, you know, that sometimes you want to say A, but since A in another context also includes B and C, so automatically you say ABC or something like that, you understand? In other words, your tongue is just flowing along, okay? According to Tosfos, Nov and Givon definitely should not have been included because it couldn't be. Why couldn't you do Sotos over there? So it says, the reason is for the following reason. It says, Mashum dehevya minchas yochid, shein kavua lo zman. The reason being that in Nov and Givon, the only type of sacrifices really that could be carried on over there were sacrifices which involve a fixed time. What is a fixed time? Fixed time means, in other words, you know, like you have to perform a daily sacrifice in the morning and in the afternoon, right? What we call the Korban Tavit, okay? Or on a Shabbos and Yom Tov, we have what we call Musafim, okay? But as a general rule, other than that, you did not have other types of sacrifice in these places. Why didn't you have them? So, I have to tell you, I mean, that they quote at the end over here that Tov and Givon, you know, there is Nov and Givon, there's a whole question about what exactly is going on. Tosfos first stresses this point. All right, and then he says that there is, however, one opinion in the Gemara's Vachem over there which says, "Kol shatziva yochid makrivim yol moed shema bidmor makrivim yol moed shema bidmor." All right. So, in that being the case, that being the case, then it is possible to do it according to another opinion. But nevertheless, we're only getting involved over here in what we would call a machlekes. But to get back to why does Tosfos first begin suggesting that Nov and Givon did not, they never could carry out this? The answer is as follows. We have in the Torah a statement which applies, of course, to the Mishkan in the wilderness, okay? And there, what it say? It says over there that if a person wants to eat meat, he's not allowed to just go and, take an animal and slaughter it and eat it. What does he have to do? He has to come and Pesach Ohel Moed, right? He has to come bring it to the entrance of the Ohel Moed, and then, there he has to slaughter the animal. And in other words, it takes on the quality of being like a sacrifice that he's able. In other words, what we would call like shlomim. Shlomim, as I said, these are the type of sacrifices where the person who brings also has a share in the eating of the sacrifice. Okay? Besides, that he allowed the kohen. The kohen gets a part of it. He's asked to invite Levi and poor people and things like that, to come into. To participate together with him, okay? So, this was the procedure as long as it was in the wilderness. Question is, once they came to Eretz Yisrael, what happened? So, we see that there were other places where the Mishkan was. It was in Gibeon, it was in Nob, okay? It wasn't these in Shiloh?
Just three places, I think.
Yeah, right, these three places. Yeah. But, during the time that these places were in existence, all that they were really doing was to perform basically sacrifices on behalf of the entire people of Israel, as I said before, and occasionally a yochid, occasionally a private individual, would also decide to celebrate in the sanctuary. Okay? As we find in the case, for example, that remember the first chapter in the book of Shmuel, we find that Hannah had a husband by the name of Elimelech, right? And every year it was his custom to go up to the house of God in Shiloh and there to bring sacrifices and, he'd bring his family, Hannah and Penina and, the children and so on and so forth, okay? So, people did occasionally. But, if people wanted, they also could perform sacrifices at what they called a bama. What is a bama?
A
private altar. Yeah. It's not a bima, it's a private altar. Bama. Okay? Right. And very often they would put it, let's say, on a high place, like on top of a hill or something like that. But a bama was like a temporary altar that people would set up in order to sacrifice and be able to eat. Okay? So this was permitted until what point?
Until the temple
was built. Exactly. Once the Beis HaMikdash was built, but he calls over here the Beis HaLomim, right? Mm-hmm. Then at that particular point, it became prohibited to have any type of a sacrifice outside. If you wanted to eat Shlomim, you had to bring it to Yerushalayim, okay? And naturally, wherever you had other obligations, Chatos and so on, so that would be brought over there. But if you simply wanted to slaughter in order to eat meat, so the Torah says already, in Parsha Re'eh that we read just the other week, okay, that Kiyachil Rishav Kechis Gvulcho Kashin to be locked, when God will enlarge the territory even as He said He would give you, and you say, I want to eat meat, right? So it says, B'chol Abbas Dafshecho Techal Bosa, right? And in that case, you're entitled to eat meat even as you desire to do it, okay? The only thing, what is the provision? It has to be slaughtered, as I have commanded you. And this is the basis of what we say, that it's halacha the Moshe Mitzinai, that there is an oral tradition going back to Moshe Rabbeinu already at Mount Sinai, that in order to slaughter an animal, it has to involve various steps that you're not allowed to transgress. Yes, it was during the time of the Beis HaMikdash, but don't forget, we say that what Elijah did, this was a horas shoah, which means this was literally an emergency situation, okay? Because he had to confront the priest of Baal and so on, so he took it to their territory, so to speak, in order to be able to confront them, okay? So from that we don't learn, further examples, but it's only we consider it like a one-time situation. Okay? All right. So, the bomos then became outlawed, once the Beis HaMikdash was established, which meant that if you were going to have the business of the Soto, then in that particular case it could only be carried on where? In the sanctuary, right, and that's it, no place else. So did you have a question you wanted to raise? No.
Shiloh was discontinued after the Beis HaMikdash.
Shiloh was destroyed. Shiloh was destroyed by the Philistines. Let's review again what we find in 1 Samuel, okay? Shortly, if you remember, after the birth of Samuel, and his mother dedicates him to, you know, to serve in the house of God. So it's written over there that the people were very dissatisfied with the children of Eli. Eli was the Kohen Gadol in Shiloh at that time. But the people were very dissatisfied with these guys because they were behaving, you know, like... they would seize the sacrifices for themselves. They were guilty of immorality and so on. So they were behaving, you know, like Clinton's gang in the White House, okay?
Don't say that.
Okay, won't say it. I take it back. Okay. They were behaving, they were misbehaving. And therefore, naturally, I mean, the people lost their respect for what was going on in the sanctuary. These people were the people who were officiating over there. Then they lost their respect for it. Right. So, as a result, if you remember, Samuel had a dream, right? And he woke up, he heard God's voice calling him, he couldn't figure out what was going on, and Eli would ask him, you know, what's going on, and when it happened three times, so then, you know, Eli recognized the fact that Samuel was getting a divine message. And he said, tell me whether it's good or bad, you know, tell me what God said to you. So Samuel said to him, God said, you know, that this tabernacle is going to be destroyed, and you and the sons, you know, they will all be killed, okay? And so then there was war between the Philistines and the Israelites. The Israelites took out the Ark of God into the battlefield because they felt that if God's Ark was there, the Oron, you know, then they would automatically win, because God would show them favor. But instead the Philistines beat them, and Eli's sons were killed because they had gone out to carry the ark over there, you know, as officiating priest, so to speak. When Eli heard the bad news, he fell and died. Literally it says that his neck was broken. Obviously he had a stroke or something, a heart attack, you know, whatever it was that finished him off, right? And the Ark of God was taken captive by the Philistines. And they didn't get it back again until the days of King David. So in the interim, we don't read of anything happening over there, except maybe there were simply bummos, because Samuel, as he grew older, so he would go from town to town, and there they would set up a bummo upon which he would offer up sacrifices. And then people would gather and they would eat, you know, from the sacrifice.
Who was that Achan?
Achan?
He tried to save
this
it
is in
from
the days of Joshua.
Oh.
The days of Joshua. Yeah.
He tried to catch the
right.
from falling, but
no,
he was
no,
struck
no,
in
the
right.
That
was Achan. Achan was in the book of Yehoshua.
No, Achan was the one who was from the Cherub.
Right, right.
About the one who put out
his hand.
Oh, that was Uzzah, his name was.
Uzzah.
Okay.
You're saying, and I didn't remember this, that the they were without the ark for a period of
years.
Entirely without.
That's correct.
Yeah. So
the ark was held captive by the Philistines.
And
well, okay. First of all, it was there for some time, but then we read that the Philistines, the city where it was kept, people began to suffer plagues.
Yeah,
so they shipped it to another city.
Right.
They also suffered plagues.
Yeah.
Then we shipped to another one.
Yeah.
And then also they suffered plagues. So finally they decided to let it go back to the territory, to the Jewish territory.
Right,
okay.
Right.
But it went back to Jewish territory, and then it remained in a certain house over there.
Right.
Obed Edom.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah.
And it stayed there until the time of King David. the days of King David, he decided, you know, that the time had come to bring it to Yerushalayim. Because, first of all, he had to conquer Yerushalayim. He had to conquer Yerushalayim. Yeah.
What happened to all the laws about sacrifice and so forth? Did they go to the hills during that time then?
No, people wanted to make a sacrifice.
Yeah,
they did.
Because there was now no official.
There was no official Mishnah, exactly. Right.
So that's why I say there was no high priest at the time in those days. Actually.
Well, you mean during the interim between
the time when
Eli died and so on?
Yeah.
No, I guess there wasn't a high priest until later on. But we find that there were
some.
But then there were kahanim. I mean, people knew that there were kahanim.
Yeah,
they weren't the only kahanim.
But it had
to
have changed the whole nature of much of what was going on during that period. I didn't remember that.
Yeah, but later on, I mean, the time of King David, then they began to reestablish the idea of, you know, having a high priest and so on and so forth. Right. But actually, you know, during the time that he was fighting and so on, he had kahanim, Tzadok and Avyosar. But nevertheless, you know, they were not called kahanim gedolim.
Mm. But did they still have to bring the festival sacrifices? What did they do?
They didn't.
Well, they didn't at all. Now they couldn't.
So
have
they
done
didn't.
That.
I
so they
guess.
Didn't during that time.
But when the kings became, they had the kings. They were doing that too. Manasseh and all of them, when they became king, weren't they doing it all over? This was later on.
Well,
they were making
once the
base
of Mikdash was established.
Yeah.
In the days of King Solomon, Shlomo, right?
Yeah, then things got organized.
And then you had an organized, you know, ritual and so on, which continued right until the end
of
the
king.
But the
kings didn't do that, and they were punished, right?
Correct.
Who was it, Jeroboam?
You had different, I mean, you know, they went after the fashions of time. First of all, the kings of Israel.
Yeah, in Israel.
They didn't, you know, they didn't commit. The Rabban ben Nevat built rival temples, if you recall, in order to prevent people from going to Yerushalayim.
Right.
And he stationed guards in order to prevent people from going to Yerushalayim on pilgrimages and things like that. And that existed right until practically the last days of the Kingdom of Israel.
Right.
Okay?
Why is all this text being spent on just a little bit of dust? Why is it so important?
Well, you raise a good question. The question really is the sanctity of these other places. Were they sacred enough in order to carry on the ritual of the Sota over there? This is really what the question is, okay?
So let's go on. You're right.
All right. Okay?
Yeah, well, we're not taking it. He's asking why the Talmud takes so much
time. Okay. So, getting back to our text over here. So it says, Im Kain, we're on line 4 right now, okay? Im Kain, if this is the case, Ma Talmud Loma, then why does the Torah say, the Karka HaMishkan?
Before HaMishkan,
right. So the answer is, Shelo Yovi Mito Kuposo. The answer is that he shouldn't pile a heap of dirt over there and then take it from the heap. So what does it mean? In other words, it means that it has to be scattered thin over the area in order to, before the Kohen can pick up some and put it into the water. But you don't simply take a load of dust and, you know, a load of dirt and throw it over there, okay? Because when I say dust, it really is dirt, I guess, is really the word.
Well, that's another notion, I guess. They go over to that, too.
Yeah. Imoral, the following question was then asked. Ain't shum afar, mouse you take ether. If there is no dirt, no dust, literally, right? Then how about putting ashes instead on it? In other words, use ashes for mixing, you know, with the Maimam Horim.
Yeah.
Okay. So it says, Ali Bodhave Shamai. In accordance with Beis Shammai's opinion, lo teboi lecha. You don't even have to ask a kasha. Why? The Amre, because Beis Shammai said, lo motzinu efer shekarui ofar. We never find, they said, that ashes should be called dust. Okay? Ki seboi lecha. But if you do ask this question, then what? It has to be al diba de Beis Hillel. It has to be in accordance with the opinion of Beis Hillel. The Amre, who said, Motzinu Efer Shekaroy Ofer. We do find that ashes are referred to also as dust. So in other words, Efer and Ofer, you could say one can substitute for the other. So my Afal God, the Ikre Ofer, Hochaba Karka Mishkan says, another Gemara asks the following questions. Okay. Granted, he says that, okay, according to Beis Hillel, sometimes ashes are also called Ofer, right? Efer and Ofer. Okay. Those, incidentally, in Hebrew, there's a difference in spelling. Efer is spelled with an aleph, and Ofer is spelled with an ayin. I mean, it's not only, you know, the voweling is different, but essentially, don't forget, it's the fact that the, you know, the letters are different. Okay. So they say, all right, granted maybe that we can say, according to Beis Hillel, that Ofer and Efer is the same thing, right? But Ofer, here in the case of the Sota, it's written the Karka HaMishkan Ksiv, right? It's written, it has to be from the floor, right from the ground of the Mishkan. Oh, Dilmo, maybe, perhaps, Hai the Karka HaMishkan Lichte Isi Ben Yehuda. Maybe the Karka HaMishkan referred to over here is in accordance with an opinion by Isi Ben Yehuda. Lichte Isi Ben Menachem Huda Asi. And it follows the opinion of Isi ben Menachem. Now, of course, we get a little bit mixed up with who is who around over here, okay? All right. If we go back to the previous page, right, so we learned that what did Isi ben Yehuda say? He said, Lohovi Karka Shilom. His point that he's making over here is that the Pasuk, the Karka Mishkan, is in order to teach us what? That other sanctuaries too can be used. That their dust too would be valid. Okay? So that's possibility number one. That was Isi ben Yehuda, right? But what did Isi ben Menachem say? He said something else. Okay. So he says, okay, Isi ben Menachem, see, question over here is maybe according to the opinion of Isi ben Menachem. What about his opinion? He says, Toshma, listen, the Omar Rabbi Yochanan, we have a teaching that Rabbi Yochanan said, Bishum Rabbi Yishmael, in the name of Rabbi Yishmael, says, Bishlosha Mekomas, it's a very interesting statement over here.
Yeah.
It says, Bishlosha Mekomas, we find three different places that halacha okeves mikra. That the halacha actually commits violence on the text of the Torah. I am translating exactly what the word okol means, okay? It means that it
crushed.
It crushes, if you wish.
It's
related to the word akev, okay, which means heal.
Heal.
But as a verb, we also find Esau complaining
Yaakov.
To Yitzchak? Mm-hmm. What did he complain to about? It says, Vayakveni Zepamayim. He has already defrauded me, so to speak, twice. You understand?
Deceiving.
In other words, he's done violence to me twice. Mm-hmm. Namely, it's Bechorah Si Lakach, right? First he took my Bechorah. And also he took my blessing. Right? He robbed me of these things. Okay? So, this is the meaning over here. To do violence, alright. So, it says that there are three places where the halacha actually does violence to a text of the Torah. HaTorah Omra, the Torah says, the Ofar, with dust. What is this a reference to? So we have to know what is the situation. Situation is, if you slaughter either a fowl or if you slaughter a kosher wild animal. By wild animal, I'm talking, for example, like, let's say you slaughtered a deer or something like that. You know, there are people now who are eating kosher venison. Okay? So at any rate, we find that under those circumstances, the law says that the chisohu be'opor, he has to cover the blood with dust. Okay? It's not a law that applies to slaughtering behemoths, but it does apply to slaughtering chickens. Slaughter a chicken, a turkey, or something like that. You slaughter a fowl, then in that particular case, you'll find that they have to cover the blood. Okay? So, what is the word that the Torah uses? Offer, right? Yet, what is the halacha? The halacha is bechol dover. You could use any kind of material in order to cover. Well, it says any kind. It's not 100% any kind. You can't take a carpet, for example, and simply throw it on top or anything like that, you understand? But it means that if you don't have dust, dirt, right, then what is basically Basila says definitely you can use Efer Kira, which means, the ashes taken from a stove. Okay?
Is the point there that it's life that has to be buried in the same kind of,
to a certain extent, I would say that's probably the reasoning behind it, right? Of course, the reason that the Torah doesn't always give us reasons for these things. You have to realize that. Torah says this is what has to be done, that's it, you know. But if you start in to interpret homiletically, we find, right. HaTorah Omra, the Torah says, Bisar, V'halocha Bechol Dover. We have a law that if a person is a Metzora, right?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, actually, it's probably in reference really more to the nausea, let's say. Okay. Case of the nausea, but it'll be applied to Metzora too. It's a similar idea. That's important. Okay. Part of the purification consists in shaving off before they can become pure. All right. Remember, in the case of a Metzora, we'll go into that a little bit later, but in the case of the nausea, the nausea had essentially three restrictions, as we already had occasion to mention from time to time. Restriction number one, he's not allowed to have anything he can't drink wine, he can't even eat grapes or even pits or skins of grapes. This is out for him, okay? That's restriction number one. Restriction number two, he has to let his hair grow, all right? Restriction number three, of course, is that he's not allowed to come in contact with the dead, okay? And if, let's say, it happened that he came in contact with the dead, then he has to start all over again, counting the days that he undertook to be a nazir. Because people would say, I'm going to be a nazir, and if they didn't specify anything further, then it meant that they had to be a nazir for 30 days. If they specified, I'm going to be a nazir for 60 days, 90 days, a year, 2 years, whatever, they could choose their own term. But needless to say, the longer the term, the more they were being deprived of whatever it was. Okay.
But no afflictions of any kind, including marital relations.
No, that they were
permitted.
Definitely, question about that. Okay, but part of the purification, the nazir is what? That he has to shave the hair that is grown. Okay, and it says over there, when he undertakes, first of all, to become a nozer, this we find in the beginning Parsha Nozer, it says, call your maiden Israel all the days that he is a nozer, ta'ar lo yovo al rosho. A ta'ar. Ta'ar means a razor is not allowed to go on his head, until the time that he fulfills the days of his nozerus, right? Ad melosim ein Israel. Okay. So part of the fact that he was now permitted, to be restored again, to be able to live normally, was the fact that what? He had to shave, okay? All right, now, what is the instrument that the Torah says? Tar. Tar is, like a straight razor. That's what a tar is, okay? for those of us who shave, according to the halacha, we should not use a tar. That's forbidden to us too. I mean, as we learn Gemara Makkos.
Mm-hmm. You may not use a straight razor.
No, not allowed to use a straight razor. Okay.
You mean just
and
a regular?
There are those
razor?
Who say that the same thing applies to a safety razor as well. Okay, because it's a blade. Not allowed
you
to
use a blade,
a blade in order to shave. So that therefore, what are you permitted to use? So the answer is, we learned you're permitted to use scissors. You're permitted to use. Today we permit the use of electric razor because it's more like a, you know, scissors that are moving back and forth.
Didn't they use a stone of some sort?
Well, they developed
sharpen a stone.
Yeah, this was the 19th century. They developed another business, and I still remember yet the saying by brother-in-law Oliver Sholem that he would put a depilatory powder on his face, right, and then use what he called a bangle.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was made out of
stick.
Cellulose or something, a stick, in order to shave it off.
Yeah.
Okay, so this is what he used.
So
the depilatory. Okay, so these were permitted. All right. So the point is, the Torah says what? Tar, right?
Mm-hmm.
But what is the halacha over here? Halacha is bechol davar, which means that you can use anything in order to cut the hair off. Okay, all right. The Torah says sefer. Now, what is this? This is a reference to a bill of divorce. Torah says if a man wants to divorce his wife, then he has to because of law sefer krisus for dos amiyota. Right? He has to write for her a sefer krisus. The English translation is bill of divorce. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And give it to her, okay? But the word safer to us would imply like
holy
a book or something,
yeah.
But it's not a book. But the point is, it's a written script
scroll.
Or something, a written scroll, okay? Because, when we talk about a Sefer Torah, obviously we don't mean a printed book like this. By a Sefer Torah we mean, the parchment scroll, okay? Now, according then to the law of the Torah, what does he have to give her? Sefer, which would mean like a sheet of parchment, right?
Mm-hmm.
Excuse me. But the halacha is the chol davar. In other words, he could give her the bill of divorce written on anything, which is torn off. In other words, it's not attached to the ground or anything like that. And the Gemara in Gittin says, that it's even permissible, let's say, to write a bill of divorce upon such things as, let's say, a leaf, sheet of paper maybe, or a piece of pottery or something like that, you understand? And give it to her, right. But of course, the din doesn't follow that today. Today, if you want to write a divorce, you have to write it on parchment and so on. So, these things. So that in the time of the Talmud, they wanted to make it possible for the woman to get her divorce bill as easily as possible. And so therefore, they permitted, the writing of the divorce decree upon anything else. But we're much stricter about that. We go back again to the original. Okay. So, at any rate, the idea is that in these three occasions, while the Torah is stricter, but when the sages came along, they made it easier. Okay? Of course, the question is going to be then, is it only these three situations, or are there other situations as well? All right. The Yim Isa. So, if that's the case, right? So lechshev name hai. So why don't we include this business that we're also talking about, namely the sota? So he says tana v'shia. Actually, the author of the statement about shlosha mekomos, he didn't include everything. There are a lot of other situations that were not included in the statement. So my shia. So he says. The high shear. He left out this. Shiur Metzora. He left out the business about the Metzora. The Tanya, where we learn, V'hoya v'yom ha'shvi'i, that on the seventh day, Yigalach is kosa aro, right? He is to shave off all his hair. Okay? Klal. Mm-hmm. This is a general rule. Then, the next words in the Pasuk are, Es Rosho, V'yes Kondo, V'yes Kabo Seino, which means his head, his beard, and also like the eyebrows, okay? V'yes Kosa Aro Yigaleach, and then, that's Prat, it says, alright? These are particular items. These are being itemized, okay? An itemization. Then the Eskosa Roy Galeach, the pasuk continues and says, and he is to shave off all his hair. So what do we see? Chozar the Cholal, right? He again gave a generalization. So if that's the case, the same pasuk has first of all Klal, a general statement, Ufrat, then itemization, which means that right. From general we go to specific things, right? Mm-hmm. And then again it goes to what?
General.
And Klal, again, general. Mm-hmm. So when we have a case like that, so it's Klal or Prat or Klal, then Iatod Don Elokein HaPrat. Then in that particular case, you have to say that the law follows only in something which is along the lines of the particular item. So, ma prot meforosh, right? Just as those things that were enumerated specifically, they are makom kinus seor, the nira. These are places where you have a bunch of hair, literally a gathering of hair, and it is visible. So, af kol makom kinus seor, the nira. Then this law would apply to any place, right, where we have a gathering of hair and it is visible. So Ma Rabbi, so what was and what did he add to this? So this says Rabbi Sayyoh Haraglayim. He adds the hair in the pubic area. That also has to be shaved, even though what? Normally the pubic area is covered, right? Because what do we say? The things that were mentioned, this, right, this, right, this, okay? It's where hair is gathered, right? And it's visible. So that therefore we would say that any hair that which is, even though it is gathered and is invisible, but we say no, the pubic hair also has to be shaved, okay? Now the question is, since we added something, maybe we should subtract something, okay? Yeah, so mine miyate, so what did he subtract? Miyate the Beis HaShechi, who the Chulei Gibbon says, the rest of the hair is subtracted. In other words, it would not have to be cut. Now, this would be hair, for example, under the armpits. Beis HaShechi is the armpits.